This is Kevin Conroy, and you're listening to The Drift Space.
Initiating neural magic in 3, 2, 1.
Rebecca, are we staying at a casino?
Yes.
We're staying at a casino.
We're staying at a casino slash hotel.
Big family reunion. Well, I was told the hotel was cheap. You know why it's cheap? Because they want our money in the casino.
Well, they got more than just a casino, apparently. They got bowling alley, a movie theater, I think a drive-in movie theater.
It's not a family reunion because Dave and I aren't there.
This is true.
That is true.
Isn't there. I can't really do Dom's voice. It always comes with sort of a like southern slur.
Family.
Yeah, you were born and raised in the South, GJ. I mean, you can't.
That's right. Family.
Family, y'all.
This is how we all talk in the South.
Yeah, that reminds me of one of my exes actually lived up in like Massachusetts or something, I forget. But when I went to meet her family for the first time, they're like, "Oh my god, you talk so well. Where's your accent?" And I immediately, I was like, "Well, I'm sorry to disappoint y'all, but none of us we got some book learning problems."
All right. Well, welcome back to the Drift Space. I am G.
I'm Dave.
I'm JR.
And I'm everybody's lifelong ambition, Rebecca.
Uncomfortable silence.
G has exited the chat.
I need an adult.
So we're going to dive in. Today we're going to dive into Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, the last film with the complete original cast of the Star Trek series. One of my top favorite Star Trek movies. I really like this one. So I was watching it yesterday, and I always forget how much I like this going into it. I was watching it thinking to myself, well, you know, another movie to, you know, just do our podcast on, have a fun time chatting about. And then I finished it, and I go, oh, my God. God, there's so much here. There is so much here. Oh my God. So let's go ahead and get into this, because I think there is a lot to cover, and I'm really excited to talk about it with you guys. In the final film with the original Star Trek series cast, the Klingon Empire reaches out to the Federation for peace in return for help after a mining accident renders them ill-equipped for survival. A reluctant Captain James T. Kirk is arm-twisted into escorting Klingon Chancellor Gorkon to peace talks before he is assassinated on Kirk's watch. Kirk is wrongfully imprisoned for conspiring to assassinate Gorkon, and with the help of the Enterprise must escape to expose the true saboteurs and save the Federation and Klingon Empire from a full-scale war. So what happens when Samantha from Sex and the City frames Captain Kirk, and why is Christian Slater waking up Mr. Sulu? All this and more on Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Is that who that was?
Yep. Yeah. And like the next year, he did True Romance.
No. Not Christian Slater, Samantha from Sex and the City.
Yeah. So I think a good starting point for discussion with this movie is to frame the original pitch, which is essentially what happens when the wall comes down in space. This movie hit theaters in 1991, having started production roughly a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was an inspiration for finding the alliance with the Klingons that had been established in Star Trek: The Next Generation. Now, I actually want to start with JR first, because some years back, JR, you mentioned this was your favorite of the original six movies, and that was because of the historical context. Do you still feel the same way after rewatching all six of these movies, or have your opinions shifted?
Absolutely. Still feel the exact same way. This is my favorite of the original series movies. I think it's still relevant today. It's kind of one of those, if you don't learn from the past, you're doomed to repeat it situations.
Go into that a little bit. Why do you think that is?
Well, not that everybody can relate to the wall thing, but surely with the prejudice of the Klingons and the Federation nowadays, we can relate that to, you know, what's going on now with all the hate that we got going on in the world with different races, different cultures. And, you know, it's about finding that common ground that we all can, you know, relate to. And just, sure, we may not see it in our time, but, you know, it will happen. It will come eventually, as long as we take the steps necessary to forge that peace.
To open the door to conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree with that. And that's the main part of this movie, is that we don't really see, you know, the final peace treaty signed between the Klingons and the Federation in this movie. What we see is the door open for conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And left open. That's a big part of why I like this movie, and I'll probably come back to that later. Dave, what are some of your opening thoughts?
The very first thing I would like to bring up here, you know, in this film, we have a lead consumed with hatred and distrust. And then basically he puts all that aside for the betterment of humanity and the spirit of that partnership, a better future. This is a people responsible for the death of his son. And the very first thing I want to say is that Haruo should have watched this prior to the events of Godzilla Planet Eater. So, yeah, the ending of this flick, not nihilistic.
Again,
have a big comeback to that one. Oh. We'll get to that in a second here. Rebecca, what are some of your opening thoughts?
Nihilistic ending.
It is nihilist. Yeah, nihilistic ending. But this one was like a big fat breath of fresh air from the last one we watched, in my opinion. But first of all, I can remember, I actually have some memory of constantly watching this at a very young age, and I think this came out on the year I was born. It did. So I was I'm a post Cold War baby. And years later, when I was able to utter words, I could not stop watching this for some reason. GJ, you can vouch for me on this one. That I just could not stop watching that movie. And I was so young, I didn't know who Shakespeare was. I didn't know who Sherlock Holmes was. I didn't even know what the Cold War was at that time. For whatever reason, I just loved it. I just kept on watching it. And to this day, I think it still holds out, especially today.
Yeah, I'll say that, Rebecca, your draw to Star Trek is very similar to mine. When I was younger, I didn't, you know, care about the thematics or the historical contexts or literary references. What I cared about was kind of the heroism to it and the pretty spaceships, of course. I'm still sitting here, you know, six movies later, looking at the Constitution class Enterprise, thinking, God, that is a sexy ship. I really do like watching it. Every time we cut back to the Enterprise A, just kind of do. It's just a great moment for me to watch that ship fly through space. And it looks so much better with ILM back in the chair.
Absolutely.
Oh, God. If there's anything to truly be grateful for, it's that ILM was back in this movie.
Well, not just ILM, Nicholas Meyer.
Nicholas Meyer was back in this movie. And, you know, we've mentioned before, he directed and wrote Wrath of Khan. He wrote parts of Voyage Home and basically came back to rescue the franchise from the Final Frontier. You know, listen, I know we went easy on Final Frontier, but there's literally no comparison. And Meyer is so fascinated with literature and history you can almost feel him straining not to make a reference behind the camera.
He's a skilled novelist.
Right.
He wrote several, at least a novel, a successful novel about Sherlock Holmes. So mm-hmm.
It's like the movie will have gone 3 minutes without a historical or literary reference, and Mayer can't take it anymore, and he has to indulge in his passion. And honestly,
that's why he hired Christopher Plummer.
Who played Gorkon?
I don't know. Werner. I just call him Ra's al Ghul.
He helps keep the intelligence in Star Trek, I feel. And he does so with a sort of cleverness you have to look for. You have to look for the context. And examples of that are, you know, the Starfleet headquarters meeting at the very beginning of the movie. After Kirk finds out that Spock vouched for the Enterprise to escort Chancellor Gorkon, he asks why, to which Spock replies, there's an old Vulcan proverb, only Nixon could go to China. I remember having to look this one up. So this phrase is, of course, a reference to Nixon's visit to China in 1972. And the meaning is that only those with a highly respectable reputation can get away with acts that others could not. And in this particular case, Kirk's reputation among the Federation and Klingons would make him immune to both Federation critics and Klingons that would want to take advantage of any other captain with this mission. And another one of my favorite moments is during Kirk's trial, where Chang yells, "Don't wait for the translation, answer me now." And that's a reference to U.S. Ambassador Stevenson and his exchange with Valerian Zorin over missiles in Cuba in 1962. He asks Zorin if the USSR was placing nuclear missiles in Cuba, and he followed it up with, yes or no, don't wait for the translation, yes or no. And I think what Mayer is doing here, Mayer's framing the importance of historical nuance throughout the story. Even lines like Kirk's, we've done our bid for king and country, is inspired by historic Britain. The idea that lines and words and idioms will be remembered and examined and dissected for years to come is something we experience in textbooks and panels on this material. And we're seeing that now. And speaking of history right now, I found that as far ahead of its time as this movie was in 1991, it still feels further ahead today. JR mentioned the racial parallels between this film and what's going on today. You know, we have a Starfleet headquarters top secret opening explaining the Klingon Empire is in need of help. And the question comes up, are they going to mothball Starfleet if they make peace with Klingons? And of course that doesn't happen. We know in Next Generation that doesn't happen, but there was concern about that early on, about dismantling the fleet. And I kind of thought to myself, you know, is Starfleet a military, or are they a peacekeeping organization, as Captain Pike framed it in the 2009 J.J. Abrams movie? You know, I felt like there's an interesting parallel between dismantling Starfleet and the calls to defund the police in some ways. Not that it's a perfect parallel, but I did find it interesting how there was almost a glimpse into the future here. Which, of course, is what Star Trek is all about. I found the dinner night and aftermath particularly uncomfortable. And here's some lines that stuck out to me. When Chekhov says, Captain Kirk invites the Klingons over for a diplomatic dinner. And Chekhov says, guess who's coming to dinner? Did anyone get that reference?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Uhura was originally supposed to say that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Guess who's coming to dinner? Based on the 1967 Spencer Tracy, right?
Uh-huh.
Spencer Tracy film.
Sidney Poitier.
Mm-hmm. A young woman who in the 1960s who brings home her soon to be husband, black widower. And that was, you know, it an interracial comedy drama. And I found that to be an interesting line to fit in there, because here the context is obviously negative from Chekhov, right?
A line Uhura does say was, "Did you see the way they eat?" To which Chekhov replies, "Terrible table manners." And then we have the two guys who we find out later were part of the assassin, who were the assassins. And they say, "They all look alike." Well, what about that smell? You know, only top of the line models can even talk. There's a lot of racially sensitive lines in this movie, and many of them are coming from our own heroes. And now later on, our heroes acknowledge their prejudices. They acknowledge their fear of the future, which they call the undiscovered country in this movie. They don't necessarily get over them. They just do the right thing. And we get that with the line at the end where McCoy says, "Well, they don't arrest people for having feelings." And Chekhov replies, "It's a good thing, too. If they did, we'd all have to turn ourselves in." And I'm struck by the idea that they don't necessarily feel differently. They just know that they're wrong, which is interesting because right now we live in a world where racists are sort of painted as these redneck neo-Nazis wearing American flag thongs while sitting on a fold-out lawn chair in a kiddie pool filled with Mountain Dew. But Star Trek VI examines a question that no one really asks. What if the racist is actually on your side? And that's a sensitive topic because we live in the middle of a cancel culture world that knee-jerk reacts to every little detail as if it's a microaggression are critiqued. And, you know, what if some of those people actually really wish they could change and are sort of allies for the greater good anyway? And this is leading me to another theme that I find very heroic, and I can already hear Dave's butt clenching from here. The crew of the Starship Enterprise have grown, and I quote Spock here, so old that they've outgrown their usefulness for the future. They saved the galaxy by keeping peace talks open, but they are not the ones the galaxy is relying on for those peace talks. Instead, they clean up a mess that they were pushed into, leaving it open for another generation. And because of their prejudices, their racism, what is the most heroic thing they end up doing after keeping talks going? They step aside for the next generation and they retire. Welcome to episode 2 of Godzilla the Planet Eater. I am G, my co-hosts here, JR, Rebecca, and Dave.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. They did not. You.
They did not commit suicide.
They did commit suicide. No. But it's the same principle. They are stepping aside. They are taking themselves out of the equation for a future that does not need them anymore.
Did they crash the Enterprise into Kittimer?
No, but it's the same principle.
It's the same principle, themselves out but of the they did it the it's, right
they
way.
They retire.
They didn't kill themselves because they were done.
The act,
they just removed the
specific,
from the
situation. No, JR, the specific...
Yes, I will acknowledge that they removed themselves from the situation because they are not the people to do that. They are not the people
right.
to...
And also, so DJ, this is the last time we ever see them.
They did not take the Enterprise and fly it into the nearest star system and...
But the situation didn't call for that. The situation merely meant that they needed to retire.
I will agree with that.
I mean, we even see in the future that, you know, okay, take Relics, the episode Relics, for example, in Star Trek The Next Generation. We have Scotty back. And the whole episode is about how he's so behind in terms of engineering that he feels like he's no longer useful anymore. But not only that, throughout the entire episode, do we remember how he reacts to Worf?
Yes.
He doesn't say a word to Worf. Even when he says goodbye to the Enterprise D crew, he just kind of looks at Worf and goes by. You know, he lives in a world where those sorts of reactions aren't necessary, aren't needed, aren't wanted anymore, which is why he needs to stay retired, which is why they all retired.
I remember reading something that Roddenberry was completely against this whole racial negativity going on in this film and in Star Trek in particular, because, well, he lived in a world where everything was fine. There's no racism. There's no conflict or whatever. But that's not really realistic. It's not realistic. And,
well, it's also not very interesting of a story to tell.
Exactly. It's not interesting. You have to have conflict in a story to make it interesting and have more people watch. And I feel like these prejudices and racisms were, as bad as they were a nice touch to mirror out what real life really is in the present. It connects us.
I also want to point out, you know, Next Generation obviously had aired before Star Trek VI. It was on TV at the time. And, right. You know, we have characters mingling with Klingons and Worf. You know, we had that episode where Riker was second in command of a Klingon bird of prey and, you know, just getting to know their culture better. And they're very open to knowing about them. And you compare that to the crew of the Enterprise here, who just criticize them. And there's so many years of hatred between them. It was hard to get over that. So what we have here is a realistic gap of those who were racist and were prejudiced and those who have evolved beyond that, as Picard would say.
It's the same thing. It's the same story with not just the Cold War, but World War II. I mean, JJ, our grandfather, he hated the Japanese for a long time. And one day he was at a church banquet for some reason, and he looked up and he met this Japanese man that he actually met face to face at the Pacific.
On one of the Pacific Islands. Was it Iwo Jima?
I believe it was.
It was Iwo Jima that he met him, yeah.
They exchanged no words. They just looked at each other and nodded. And I remember Dad telling us about this, and our dad asked him, how did you feel? What was going on through your mind? And our grandfather said, we were just kids trying to survive, trying to get home. I feel like you're never too old to learn something. You're never too old to be out of reach of something. You can always learn something, no matter what age you are.
Unless you're Scotty.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we talked about history parallels, and we talked about what happens when you have a skilled novelist directing a movie, and how the Cold War is depicted here, and how Shakespeare plays a major role as both admiration and foundation and practice for Klingons, in a way. That was hilarious, by the way, how Chang says, you've never heard Shakespeare once you hear it in the original Klingon version.
I love that.
Yeah.
I like the idea that this is so far in the future that and Shakespeare is still so highly revered that no one really knows what planet he's from even anymore.
That was also a nod to what the Third Reich in Germany, they tried to claim Shakespeare as their own. So that was a nudge.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, how interesting.
Yeah, I read about that. And I want to jump on the fact how much I love watching the parallels between Kirk and Chang and Spock and Valeris. Now, each character is a reflection of the other character through their original ideologies. Kirk and Chang, they're two leaders struggling with what the future holds after fighting and winning battles throughout their whole lives. The very idea of peace between two very unlikely nations or species is not just unthinkable, but just downright sacrilegious in their souls. And for Spock and Valeris, it's basically a master passing the mantle down to the pupil, to the next generation, preparing his heir for the new era. Valeris was the ideal student that could have brought peace and prosperity throughout the whole galaxy. However, as stories go, and as well as real life itself, things didn't go exactly the way they planned, which is also part of Shakespeare. Kirk is framed and thrown into space Siberia, otherwise known as Rura Pente, where he and Bones experience the most harrowing labors and horrors. And as such, within that calm of the storm, Kirk begins to question what the future of the galaxy will be like, and contemplating that whether his own beliefs and pains they're nothing. They're nothing compared to what the trillions and trillions of races will have to endure if peace is not given a chance. And for Spock, he probably experienced the deepest pain of all, betrayal from Valeris, his daughter figure. And what's even worse, Spock succumbs to even harming Valeris through forced mind-melding, out of duty, obviously, but something that is completely out of character for him. It seems that Kirk and Spock switched roles, where Kirk ends up becoming the logical peacemaker, and Spock results to violence, in a sense, for all for the sake of a brighter future for the generations to come. And even later on, it was Kirk reassuring and counseling Spock instead of the other way around. It really showed how much both Kirk's and Spock's characters developed, rubbed off on each other for so long. But while this film does talk about how people are afraid of change, I think it also talks about challenging your own beliefs and your mistakes, then looking at things from the other person's perspective and coming up with your own conclusion. And Kirk, Spock, Chang, and Valeris were all given the challenge to test their perspectives and politics, and only two of them, well, semi-succeeded in seeing that their own narrowed perspectives were simply not enough for long-term events. They had to see the world or galaxy through the other person's point of view in order for a brighter future and a brighter generation. Now, as you mentioned before, GJ, do they feel any different after all of that? Probably not. They probably still feel like Klingons are still animals and they're dangerous, of course, but
I think they acknowledge that they have those feelings, but that those feelings are wrong, making them the wrong people to continue this path forward. Yeah,
exactly. And they feel like they're not the ones that can bring peace. It's the next generation that can do that. I also want to mention, I love that Michael Dorn guest starred as Worf's grandfather. His character's name is Colonel Worf, and it's a perfect foreshadowing how the current Worf would end up being part of the Enterprise and defending her next captain. Like grandfather, like grandson. I like that part.
There was also that other sort of nod to Worf and his past with the conference being held at Kittimer as well.
Oh.
And the Kittimer massacre.
I completely forgot about that, yeah.
Yep. Sins of the Father, I believe it was.
Yeah, the Kittimer massacre. That's where he lost his parents. Or, yeah.
And that's where it was, quote, discovered that Worf's father had something to do with the Kittimer massacre. Anywho, Rebecca, you talked a little bit about the, you know, I'll put it less eloquently, the bromance between our heroes here, specifically between Spock and Kirk. And one of the things that really struck me in this movie was they finally said what I feel like all of us have sort of been thinking, where Kirk gets into talking about the difference between the polarities and the extremes with the approaches that Spock takes and the approaches that Kirk takes. And he talks about that and says, you know, we're both extremes and reality is probably somewhere in between. And I just really liked that a lot.
Yeah, I love that line.
It really, it really accentuates and ties a bow on, you know, why they work so well together. And I just thought it was a really sweet moment for those characters there.
Spock, you want to know something? Everybody's human. I find that remark insulting.
Insulting.
I love that line.
How would you guys have felt if Nick Mayer got his way and Valeris was actually Savick?
Would have been a little nihilistic.
I'll take this one. Yes, I read that the traitor was originally going to be Lieutenant Savick, and Kirstie Alley was asked to reprise her role. However, Roddenberry disagreed with that because Savick's character was too popular and didn't want to tarnish her reputation. Also, Alley was very self-conscious about her weight gain that year, and she was also at the height of her career as Rebecca Howe in Cheers. Awesome show, by the way. The only one thing I missed on Hallmark Channel. But
well,
Hallmark!
Exactly. I mean, I hate their movies. But I'm actually with Roddenberry on this one. I'm glad they did not use Savick's character for this one, because she was very likable, and she was pure, And I read somewhere that she was just a girl learning new things, while Valeris was a woman taking things in her own hands. I may have paraphrased that, but I even read somewhere when we were doing the Search for Spock episode that Savick's character might have been pregnant with Spock's child after the whole Ponfar thing on Genesis, and she stayed behind Vulcan to take care of their unborn child, which probably been another reason not to be in part of the sixth film, but obviously they scrapped that part out. So, but
well, that could have explained the weight gain, though.
Yeah, that could.
Pull a Daphne with this.
Exactly. Where's Savick? Oh, she's at the fat farm. Get Martin Crane in here.
I don't think I would have hated the idea of Savick returning for this particular part, because it would have done a few things. They wouldn't have had to introduce a whole new character. If there's any problem I have with the movie, it's this. I found Valeris kind of a know-it-all. And what's worse is that she was right. And not in the same sense that Spock always knows everything, but just it didn't make sense that she knew things that the rest of the crew did not. You know? Like firing a phaser on board a starship sets off alarms. That was questioned by Chekhov, and she shows him why that wouldn't be possible. It wouldn't be possible to vaporize the boots that they're looking for without, you know, bells and whistles going off. And I'm sitting here going, why didn't Chekhov know that? I really didn't like how this movie made Chekhov just kind of come off as an idiot the whole time. He's always asking these questions, you know, what are we looking for? Why didn't they just vaporize them? You know, a bird of prey cloaked? You know, he just seemed to be the guy who really didn't know what was going on. And I didn't like the portrayal of his character, especially in light of this new young character who really shouldn't know as much about the Starship Enterprise as he does.
The one thing I'll add, like, I agree. I didn't care for Valeris. I thought, you know, having Savick in there would have amplified so much meaning into it. Mm-hmm. So you think about Spock almost plays like a mentor type role to her. Yeah. And given the history there, I feel like the betrayal would have hit so much harder and would have warranted the emotion that we did experience from Spock.
And exactly.
Versus this, you know, for lack of a better term, a hotshot Vulcan came out of the Vulcan Academy and Spock was just merely impressed with her. We don't have a whole lot of other history there other than the fact that, you know, he was impressed by her laurels and her achievements, and that was it. But with Savick in there, we already know that there's a service history there, and there is, of course, the history that we see, or perhaps don't see and infer from Search for Spock. So there is a lot there with Savick, and for Savick to have been the one to have betrayed the crew like that and to have sabotaged this mission in that way, that would have hit Spock so hard.
It would have been a gut punch for all of us.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. I think the story works as is. I'm not going to lie. It the film is fantastic. This is at least my second favorite Star Trek film of the franchise. But I do think, you know, Roddenberry should have let up on what Mayer wanted to do. Because let's be honest, this was Mayer's character. Why not let him use his character? It didn't make much sense. But yeah, no, I completely agree that the backlog of what we had between Spock and Savick would have hit a lot harder.
I thought the Klingons looked cool, the character design.
Yeah, the ridges were finally coming into place.
I thought the ridges were kind of downplayed in this movie.
You think
like we look at Christopher Plummer. Christopher Plummer even asked for the makeup to be kind of minimalistic so he could express a little bit better.
And so the reason that I like it is because of the message of the movie. Putting aside the prejudices, you mute some of those things to start to see and experience these emotions and this demeanor of this other species in a way that's a lot more human-like, I guess. And you're able to more easily bridge that gap than underneath all of these prosthetics that make it much more difficult to emote other than with theatrics, for lack of a better term.
Okay.
Right, right. Because before Next Generation anyway, the original cast, the original series had never shown the Klingons in a kind of sympathetic, empathetic light. And they're really piling on this sort of, you know, Klingons are people and they're dying. And that line from Kirk early on, let them die, which William Shatner actually had a problem with, but let them die, was such a
shock.
Yeah, it was coming from our hero who we idolize so much. And in this future where we're all supposed to be very open to other cultures and whatnot, it was polarizing to see that, you know, because I mean, we all experience anger and sometimes we heap that anger on whole cultures. We all lived through 9/11. We all are aware that as soon as the towers went down, there was this sort of anti-Muslim, anti-Middle Eastern sentiment amongst the country. We felt a deep-rooted prejudice for an entire nation of people or region of people because of the actions of a few. And in the same case here, we have Kirk saying, let them die, to an entire planet because the actions of few had killed his son. I remember one of my English professors said years ago, if you walked in your house and you walked in on someone who had killed your family and there just happened to be a gun sitting on a table by the door next to you, would you have the self-control not to pick it up and, you know, take them all out? He just wanted to show that even, you know, as smart as he was, he wanted to show he was human too. He says, I think it would be difficult for me because in anger, we say and do things that aren't necessarily ethical. There's just a lot there in this movie to chew on and think about. And it almost bites. It hurts a little to kind of examine these things about ourselves as I watch this movie.
It's pretty deep, bro.
Thanks, sis.
You guys have just been hitting the nail on the head with so many subjects that this movie has to offer. I especially like, I think, was it David Dark who said that?
It was David Dark.
Yeah, that sounds like something who said that. Say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was always really good at making me think.
I know. He was really good at making me uncomfortable and then think. That was...
But, you know, not only do they, you know, we talk about a lot... The majority of this conversation has also been about the Klingons, but, you know, what about the shapeshifter in that prison? As soon as they found out that she was a shapeshifter, they kind of looked at her differently. And they were like, oh, well, isn't this interesting? The movie is an interesting look at human nature in itself. Because whether we want to admit it or not, we all have some type of prejudice, even if we don't act on it. It's a good dissection of being human and learning to understand our prejudice and work on them and fix them.
Challenge your perspective.
Challenge your perspective. Exactly right, Rebecca. I can't say anything that you guys already haven't said. So it's just interesting to listen to the conversation without interrupting and just being like, oh yeah, that was a good point. I feel the same way. I have no other insight to bring to this conversation.
Except the shapeshifter thing. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, the idea of prejudice, I mean, this entire episode movie has been kind of centered around that. Because this was 91, right?
Mm-hmm.
1991?
Yeah.
That was the same as season 4 of The Next Generation, when we're introduced to a new species called the Cardassians as
well.
Oh, yeah. Their leader's name is Kim.
We get the episode of Next Generation where we get to experience Miles O'Brien and his hardcore prejudice against the Cardassians. It's just interesting that you have these really hard-hitting deep dives into the idea of prejudice and kind of making us take a look at our own lives through that lens, all in 1991. So, I mean, obviously a very hot topic that year, especially, you know, considering what was going on in the world at that time as well. But I just wanted to bring that in as with the introduction of the Cardassians and how that sort of continued even after peace was achieved with, you know, later that year, unification, peace was achieved between Vulcans and the Romulans. And, you know, everybody's pretty much happy. And now we have this entire other species to hate now, right? So it's a thing that keeps on coming up in Star Trek Next Generation that I personally like, because it kind of keeps us, it keeps the viewer in check.
Well, like we've been saying every Star Trek episode, it refusal to find something relevant in the series. I mean, here we are, how many years later, talking about prejudice, and the topic is still relevant nowadays? You know, it's
more so.
Exactly. Arguably. It's, I mean, yeah, Star Trek just hits on those topics so well.
And it did it again in Discovery as well.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. It did. Yep. Oops. I think part of it is that it's interesting JR mentions that this is just human nature and something we're going to have to continue to learn about ourselves. And Dave, you mentioned keep in check, keep the audience in check and whatnot. It's interesting that in Star Trek, once the Federation or people in Starfleet get over their racism or prejudice of one alien species, then another pops up where they have to do this all over again. And it's not simply that, you know, well, we're good friends with this species now, and then poof, another alien species pops up and they're like, ew. It's that there's normally a history behind that as well.
There is. And I think some of this comes down to that fear of confronting that. And that was another big message of this movie, was the fear of that change and
yes,
and what that would mean. And it's interesting because that's that fear of the unknown and that fear of change is something that has been consistent since the 1960s with Star Trek. I think of, you know, episodes of the original series. I think of ton of episodes of Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, all of this. And it's about that fear of change. And then one of the core messages is exploring where no man has gone before, the unknown, and to go fearlessly into that unknown territory, uncharted territory. And I think that sort of transcends exploration of space, and it really applies to, you know, exploration of self.
Right. And I've always taken the exploration of space as kind of this overarching metaphor of the exploration of self, you know, going into the unknown, going into this unknown future with a people that the crew of the Enterprise was always in this Cold War against and always used to hate and have these prejudices against is terrifying to them. And it's interesting that it's more terrifying to them than diving straight into a big blue cloud that could take out the planet Earth in one hit.
That takes them an hour to sail through.
That takes them an hour to sail through. You know, Kirk had no problems diving headfirst into that. But being put on a mission to escort a Klingon ambassador to peace talks, well, now hold on, pump the brakes. That's fascinating.
That's because everybody's worst enemy is themselves.
Yeah, is their true fears. Kirk doesn't fear a giant big cloud that grew from one of our satellites. He fears a change. I think it was an incredible way to sort of retire the characters, is for them to open up the door for a strange new world and leave quietly into the night.
Second star to the right and straight on to morning.
Straight on to morning, which I like the idea that they, you know, would want to go somewhere where they would stay young.
Yeah, I was gonna point out the relevance of that line. It, you know, is stay young, but at the same time, in the eyes of the fans, stay immortal. Stayed looked on as the immortal crew of the Enterprise that we all know and love so dearly. Instead of, you know, just riding the ship out until they're forced to retire.
Right. Yeah, I like that idea that the line is represents a sort of, you know, building them up as these unkillable legends in the eyes of the fans. I didn't think about that perspective.
Yeah, they are our today's heroes, icons, Shakespeare, the lores.
You know, we've gotten really heavy on this episode. I wanted to talk about how we've gotten the murder mystery on this episode too. Like
with the Scooby Gang.
Yes, I love the dinner theater who did it kind of aspect of this movie.
Who done it? Yeah, yeah. Well, it was set up as a Sherlock Holmes
exactly
mystery.
Yeah,
you know, whatever improbable must be the truth. That's a
but the Holmes reason line. I related it to dinner theater is the whole like every time their starbase was like, get back here. They're like, hey, I hear the engines are still broken. That's going to take like a week to fix them? What's that all about?
I love the, yeah, what was
could
the
take weeks, sir.
Yeah, it's the exchange between
Mr. Scott.
Scott.
I hear you're having trouble with the engine. Well, there's nothing wrong with the bloody thing, Mr. Scott. If we return to space dock, we will never see the captain or Dr. McCoy again.
Could take weeks, sir.
The writing in this movie, I mean, we could go on and on. I don't know what my favorite line is. And
oh, even, I like, do. I can't believe I kissed you. Must have been your lifelong ambition.
There's even smaller ones with the way they're delivered. Like when he walks by Spock after inviting everyone to dinner. Walks by Spot and goes, I hope you're happy.
Earth, Hitler, 1938. Everything I just...
so awkward.
I never saw Spock so dumbstruck, so... Oh my god, what did you...
what did you do? You know, it was a nice way to bring comedy into such a...
Levity, yeah,
levity into such a powder keg.
Yeah, and it was good that we had one more laugh before Gorkon's cruiser got shot. Because I love the line, Chekhov, do you know anything about energy surge? And he goes, only the size of my head.
And then Kirk turns, mine too.
And I agree, we did need that. And it was never at the expense of the themes. I never once felt that they were making light of the themes of change, of the future, of prejudices. They were merely little lines interspersed in the film to make the characters pop a little bit more. Right. You know, they drank at dinner. They're a little hungover.
I mean, even when they're getting... in court, I remember you drinking a large amount of Romulan ale. We all did!
Oh, personal log. No Romulan ale during...
Diplomatic Yeah. Yeah. One thing I do want to bring up is... This movie has really hammered down the whole Enterprise taking a pounding from here on out. This becomes the norm, with the exception of, I think, First Contact, from here to even the Star Trek Beyond.
Okay, Beyond, I mean, it really takes a pounding.
It did in Into Darkness as well.
Yeah.
And in Generations.
Yeah, in Generations.
Next episode.
You know, Nemesis.
They have just a ball of a time ripping up the Enterprise. Often this is the most powerful, fastest flagship of the Federation. I wouldn't be too terrified of the Federation if I keep seeing what happens to the Starship Enterprise. I know it's not the fastest, biggest, bestest ship in this movie, but there's a reason they put Kirk on the Enterprise for the specific mission, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean, he's the one who knows his ship backwards and forwards.
And it's the legendary Enterprise.
Exactly.
Right? I really loved the submarine-esque battle going on at the end. And I really think this movie, with all of its heavy themes and the buildup, really earned that final battle, too. It was a very satisfying, different... It wasn't your typical, you know, fly around and shoot them up type of deal. It was, you know, Marco Polo.
Yeah. It goes back to what we talk about, Wrath of Khan.
Uh-huh.
Submarine battle.
It was an interesting spaceship battle, right. Mm-hmm. And I did love that Excelsior got
some action. Yeah, we finally get to see what this Excelsior has.
Yeah.
God, I loved that.
Great delivery by George Takei on that. I really appreciated his role in this movie.
What about
Mr. Sulu? You realize that talking with us, you're what was it?
Breaking Federation rules or whatever.
I'm sorry, Captain, but you're breaking up.
Should we report it? You think?
You kidding?
Well, I think we've about hit the wall here on Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. We do have a question about the film, which comes from Nathan of the Monster Island Film Vault, who we had on our Star Trek 4 episode, I believe.
Hi, Nathan.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it was 4.
Nathan said, he was disappointed that we didn't invite him on this one. Sorry, Nathan. But his question, how do you feel about the Klingons' characterization being a bit different here? They're more samurai-like than Vikings. Personally, he liked it. And his second question, does its end of the Cold War story still hold up after 30 years?
I have two answers for those two questions.
Well, hopefully one for each.
Yeah. One for each.
No, just two for
you
one.
You can answer. The first one, honestly, I don't think we've seen enough Klingons throughout the films other than the search for Spock to determine how they were characterized. But when we did see them, yes, they're more ruthless, more like ruthless space pirates than Vikings, in my opinion. And they definitely distributed a lack of honor in the third film, but we're given more of what they were truly like in the sixth film. I do agree that part of their characterizations were quite samurai-like, and the samurai were indeed all about honor and discipline, and anything less would be worse than death. And like the samurai, the Klingons had their own laws, their own traditions, and their own code. However, I also think they seem to have a combination between Mongolian, Russian, and German vibe to them due to their mannerisms, the way they dressed, and how very elitist they would speak. During the Cold War-ish, I'm not talking about like right now, but as I said before, they claimed Shakespeare to be Klingon, so there you go. And for the second question, does it still hold up 30 years later? Absolutely. Because if people paid attention to the world lately as nations are coming out from the pandemic, they're asking, who can we trust? Can we trust ourselves? Can we trust our own government? Or are we going to have to educate ourselves and challenge our own beliefs to see that something like this doesn't happen again? I think it truly does. People are more afraid, more prejudiced toward the Chinese. People are going to have to start opening up their minds, their hearts even, to see their perspectives and knowing that it wasn't purely the Chinese people's fault. It was the government's fault. And I'm kind of getting on a little rant here, so I'll just stop at that.
Yeah, I feel like we really didn't talk much about like how this really applies today.
Oh, you're funny. This is the new Is It Nihilistic, isn't it? Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. What are the questions we got?
Oh, that was it. That was it. That was what Nathan had for us.
Thanks, Nathan.
We'll be here another hour.
Does anyone have any final thoughts on Undiscovered Country?
This is fun. We should do it again.
Oh, okay. Next week.
I think we should get on with our fanboy 50. Not too much Romulan ale for me.
Who had the last fanboy 50?
You mean the poorly pitched?
Oh, sorry, the poorly pitched. Who had the last poorly pitched?
I had the poorly pitched. And for all you who don't remember, it went something like this. A foreigner loses his money in San Francisco and can no longer get home. Do we have guesses? Anybody? Anybody?
I want to say the freshman, but I don't think that's right.
No, that was New York.
Yeah, that was New York. My bad. Sorry.
Coming to America. Was that San Francisco or is that New York?
Yes, New York.
That was New York. We keep.
They're all based on New York. Foreign.
Star Trek 4.
That works actually. Sonic the Hedgehog.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, that was good.
I found that appropriate on our fast episode. Gotta go fast.
All right. Who's taking the poorly pitched this week?
I've got like seven different ones that I could do potentially.
I thought Sonic was good.
It was good. I thought it was good.
All right. An old guy kidnaps an overweight Asian boy.
I know what it is.
What? Okay. An old guy kidnaps an overweight Asian. Oh.
Next time on the Drift Space.
I figured that'd be an easy one, but a fun one nonetheless.
All right.
Okay.
Fanboy 50, who's up?
I'll go. This was supposed to be for our last one, but since we didn't do it, I'll go ahead and say it. This is a rant, so just bear with me. All right.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, go.
So the next Transformers film has been titled Transformers The Rise of the Beast. And yes, we're talking about Maximals and Predacons. I'm delighted to say that Peter Cullen is returning as Optimus Prime. Hell yeah. Recently, Ron Perlman has been cast for Optimus Prime Mole. Now, I like Ron Perlman, and this is nothing against him, but I deeply wish they would get Gary Chalk to reprise his role as Primal. I mean, he along with David Kaye, Scott McNeil, Ian James Corlett, and many others, we would not have any continuation with the Transformers lore if it weren't for them. I feel like Hasbro and Paramount owe a lot to Gary Chalk for a badass performance as the Boss Monkey. I mean, there was a petition to get Chalk back as Primal as well as other casts, and I signed it up, of course, but it might be too late for this particular film, but we can't give up on Chalk for future Transformers franchises.
Time.
Thank okay. you.
I like Thank how you for keeping your pitch the same this time.
You're not going off the pterodactyl.
Sorry,
I really wanted more Primal, but they didn't get Primal, and that's not Primal.
But it's true.
I love how many times you said Primal. I could only think of Daphne. And then I tried to put it in the boom box, but it didn't work in the boom box. And when I wanted to take it out of the boom box, it was already.
All right, who's up?
I'll go.
Okay, set, go.
So this was supposed to be last week, but since I had more time, I got to cover more of it. Here's a list of Batman movies I think you should watch. Batman Year One, Dark Knight Returns Part 1 and 2, Under the Red Hood, Batman Harley Quinn, Mystery of the Batwoman, Return of the Joker, Sub-Zero, Batman vs. the Kingdom, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Long Halloween. Here are movies you should not watch. The Killing Joke, Hush, Death in the Family, Gotham by Gaslight. You guys know what you've done. You hurt me, and it makes me sad. Bake my time.
I didn't
mind Death in the Family.
Really?
I thought it was interesting.
I didn't hear Mask of the Phantasm.
Well, I didn't get the Mask of the Phantasm. That's a given, though.
Time.
Thank you for letting us to contribute.
Dave, why did you like Death in the Family?
Well, he can tell us over his fanboy 50 on your set. Go.
I didn't say I liked Death in the Family. I said it was interesting. I thought it's like DC tried their hand at Bandersnatch, which I thought was kind of cool. Anyway, I actually watched Loki and I've been enjoying it. I'm like 4 episodes in. It's not bad. I'm digging it so far. That's all. Thank my time.
Okay. 35 seconds in. All right. Who's got me?
I got you. Are you going to need the whole thing?
I don't know. We'll see.
All righty. Are you ready?
We are ready.
Set. Go.
I, too, have been watching Loki, and I've really been enjoying it. I think that the show is probably the best. No, there's no probably about it. The show is definitely the best of the Marvel shows that have come on Disney Plus. I was... I enjoyed the first half of WandaVision. I thought Captain Falcon Soldier kind of just meandered most of the time, but I really enjoy the writing and the themes going on in Loki right now, and I really really hope it sticks the landing on Wednesday, because that's been a problem with these Marvel shows lately, is they just don't want to end on a high note. So that would be my fanboy 50.
Time. See, none of us used it except for Rebecca, who ranted. I could have talked about shoestring fries again.
I'm sure you could have. I'm honestly shocked that we didn't get another dad joke in there. Too late, though.
I think we need a whole episode of Dave talking about shoestring french fries.
Hey, I can always splice that in. I edit.
I mean, that should be our series finale for this.
This is the last episode of the Drift Space. Dave, go.
No, we'll call it something, you know, like
our season finale.
You know, we're finally going to cover Citizen Kane. And then I'll be
just shoestring.
I just talk about shoestring french fries for like an hour and a half, and I just go, Rosebud, thank you, goodbye.
All right. Anyway, thank you all for playing along with us on our episode of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. We hope you enjoyed it. My name is G. You can find me on Twitter at Gman of Mysterioid. And you can check out my Substack called Deferential Wrath of Arresting Markalite Canon at markalite.substack.com.
I'm Dave, and I do another geek podcast with my wife called Pizza and Parsecs. And you can check us out on pizzaandparsecs.com.
I'm JR. If you liked my contribution to this topic, I've got the Twitter at littleman_says1. I've also got the Instagram at littlemancosplay.
And you've got the touch.
I've got the power. Bum, bum,
bum. And I'm Rebecca. If you'd like to check out some of my artwork, you can find me at the Linktree app, linktr.ee/RebHudge. Commissions are still open, and please feel free to ask me more about my Transformers rants.
You can also find her in a few weeks. Where, Rebecca?
At Buckhead, Atlanta, Georgia, at the Power Rangers Stop and Pop convention. I will have my own artist table. So
yeah.
Come by and see me.
Buy that Sailor Moon picture. That's my favorite.
Buy the Sailor Moon picture.
The Sailor Scouts picture.
Can you print that on the t-shirt?
You know what?
I want that as a t-shirt.
I was thinking about making stickers of each of the Sailor Scouts for the...
No, just make that a giant sticker. Oh, I would put that on the back of my car.
A big car magnet of Sailor Venus.
Just... I would do that in a heartbeat.
And we are the Drift Space, trying to figure out how to put images of mangled Sailor Scouts on magnets for your car. Please take a look at our show at bit.ly/TDSlinks, where you can find us on all your favorite podcatchers. And if you liked this episode, you can find us on all the socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at The Drift Space. And remember to always stay strapped.
This is fun. We really should do this again.
When should we do it?
2 weeks from now. Anybody good?
Oh, okay. All right, that sounds good.